38 years ago today, in 1976, the United States Supreme Court reinstituted the death penalty. A 10-year moratorium on executions ended a year later when convicted murderer Gary Gilmore was killed by a firing squad in Utah. That same year, 1977, Oklahoma became the first state to adopt lethal injection as a means of execution. Oklahoma is, of course, the state where convicted murderer and rapist Clayton Lockett's execution by lethal injection was botched earlier this year. Today, we have the first of two conversations about the death penalty, beginning with a supporter, Robert Blecker, a criminal law professor at New York Law School and author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. Robert Blecker, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, first, make your case for the death penalty.
I can do that in three words. Some people deserve it. Actually, that was four. But there are some people who kill so viciously with an attitude that is so callous, so cruel, so wanton, that they simply deserve to die. And we have a correlative obligation to execute them.
Well, how do you determine who deserves to die?
Well, that's the rub. There are certain categories of people. There are boundary problems, of course, but there are certain categories of people. The sadistic killers, rapist murderers of children, mass murderers, terrorists. There's a group that we can clearly identify. The controversy, of course, takes place at the boundaries.
Well, explain. Give us an example of one of the people at the boundaries that you would be torn on.
Well, here's one that I think definitely does not deserve, which unfortunately might qualify in certain jurisdictions. A kid tries to hold up a convenience store, and in the clearest case, the clerk reaches for a gun, which he has every right to do, of course, to defend himself and to prevent the robbery, and the kid, out of nervousness, shoots him. That would constitute an intentional killing in the course of a felony robbery, which in many jurisdictions would make him death eligible. He most certainly should not be death eligible for that. Another category which shouldn't deserve the death penalty and yet becomes death eligible in some places is someone who is serving life in prison and kills again. The theory is that there's no other way to deter him because he has nothing else to lose. But of course, the reality is that lifers in prison have the most to lose because this is their home for the rest of their lives. And there is a threat, and the threat is transfer, and the threat is punitive segregation.
As you know, though, there are a lot of people who think that in any case, there should not be the death penalty. What do you say to those people? People who would say, by the way, that life in prison is often worse.
Well, those are people who are generally ignorant about what life in prison is. I've spent 3,000 hours over the last 25 years in prisons in seven states and maximum security prisons and on death rows interviewing convicted killers and the people who guard them. And the fact is that life inside prison does not resemble what most people imagine it to be. For one thing, and most perversely, we've completely disconnected crime from punishment. Daily life for those who serve life without parole is not about punishment. It's about privileges.
But then aren't you making the case for an overhaul of the system rather than the death penalty?
Well, the fact is if we did adopt a life without parole that was really punishment, then the support for the death penalty would drop and it would be less important. But we're not about to do that. And when you ask the corrections officers what's their goal, what's their mission? By the way, if you read the mission statements of the Departments of Corrections, and I've read all 50 and the federal one, there is no mention of the word punishment, nowhere in any mission statement in any Department of Corrections. So you ask them, well, what's your goal? What's your mission? What are you trying to do here? And they say almost with one voice, safety. We want to keep the people safe from the prisoners. We want to keep the prisoners safe from each other. And we want to keep the staff safe from the prisoners. So they're not about punishment. And you ask about punishment fitting the crime, and they're not concerned with that. So if we did have a life without parole, that was really punishment. If we really had our murderers live in a style that befitted what they had done, then again, the pressure for the death penalty would certainly be eased. And even people like me who would still support it would not think it's as necessary as it is. But given what we have now, if we're committed to justice, there is one and only one legitimate response for the worst of the worst of our worst, and that's death.
One more thing I want to ask you about, and that is that regardless of the methods, we know there are mistakes, that people on death row have been exonerated by DNA evidence. Why doesn't that make you worry that some innocent people have been and would be executed under the death penalty?
Well, I certainly am worried. As a retributivist who believes that people should get what they deserve, I am just as committed to making certain that people are not overpunished. Our great nightmare is, of course, the execution of an innocent person, which is why I support the Innocence Project and have started a project of my own at my law school in which we're searching for people who are serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes. The ACLU has documented recently that there are 3,100 people in the United States serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes. That's obscene. It's horrifying to think that we might execute an innocent person. And we should be taking precautions against that. In the book, I advocate a different and higher burden of persuasion in the death penalty context. It's not enough to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it. We should be convinced with no residual doubt, no nagging doubt, that he did it, and also be convinced to a moral certainty that he deserves it. So mistake is, of course, something that's very important. But the fact is that we take risks with our own lives and the lives of people we love daily. I walk my grandchildren in a stroller down Broadway, and I recognize that there's an infinitesimal possibility that a truck could jump the curb and kill them. I'll expose them to that risk for the sake of my convenience. Surely if we will expose the risk of death of those we love for the sake of convenience, we should be willing to expose to a risk of death those we rightfully detest for the sake of justice.
A great argument, except for the person who is listening to this who was exonerated after being on death row.
We do not know for certain, and we don't even know with a high probability that we've in fact executed an innocent person in the modern era. My best guess is that we have. And that's horrifying. But once again, think of all the other innocent people that we've been killing for much lesser purposes. People we kill because we don't spend money on highway safety. People we kill because we allow streams to be polluted. People we kill because we don't punish the General Motors executives, lawyers, and engineers who allowed a faulty ignition switch to stay in the cars. And there we consciously make policy decisions to subject the innocent citizenry to all sorts of risks of death. And they're the innocent citizenry. Surely, in order to achieve justice, we have to take risks. And of course, it would be horrifying if it were me or somebody I loved. It's horrifying if we execute any innocent citizen. But the risks are very low. They can be diminished further. And we have a responsibility to pursue justice, even if that requires taking an infinitesimal risk.
Robert Blecker, author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. He's also a criminal law professor at New York Law School. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
So that's the case for the death penalty. And of course, we welcome your thoughts at hereandnow.org. Tomorrow, we'll hear an argument against from Kirk Bloodsworth, who was sentenced to death and sent to prison, but later exonerated.
You know, honestly, sitting there all those years, 8 years, 10 months and 19 days, I have to tell you that, you know, we can get it wrong, and we have many times.